I'm going to call the committee to order. And I think that we did have a quorum at one moment, so I'm going to declare a quorum. And Representative Norton, I'm sure you've read the minutes and fully understand them and move them. Thank you, Representative Norton. All in favor of accepting the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, they are adopted. Let's see. I have to go through this. I want to, I'm going to make announcements early and late, and before we get going too far. February 2nd, we are, the committee is going out to tour St. Jude's in Minnetonka, and that's Friday from 9:30 to 11:30 or thereabouts. And I am, depending on how many people tell me they're going to join us, we'll either provide transportation or we'll just carpool out to St. Jude's. And then also, that is on February 2nd, Friday, and then on February 1st, the university is putting together a symposium on the biofuels in the future. That is Thursday, February 1st from 1 o'clock or 1:30 till 4:30. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to make it, but I'm sending one of my staff to go give me an update, and if anyone will make sure, I think that's in the packets, to take a look at that, if that works for you. I think that's going to be an important part of our committee. And having said that,
Mr. Chair, can you just repeat, what's the time on February 2nd?
February 2nd, that's the Friday from 9:30 in the morning till about 11:30 is the tour. So we'll probably leave here 8:45.
Okay. Okay.
And there'll be a letter to everyone's desk or to their office today. So you'll have a, and I am extending the invitation to the Senate committee and a few others. So hopefully it'll be large enough that we can provide some transportation, a van or something like that. We also have a new DFL staff member, Laura
Sales.
And Dan, our past DFL staffer, was given the, he's staffing capital investment. So, and he said he was going to be overworked, so they called in the A-team for us. With that, I would like to open it up to an overview today of the biopharmaceutical industry in Minnesota. We have got a nice-sized company with MGI Pharma. They're going to be part of the primary presentation today. And if I could call them down to the witness stand or the display stand or whatever you would like to call it.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ray Frost. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for MGI Pharma. Let me start by saying it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning and sharing what is, I hope to get a sense of what is a different biopharmaceutical company. You know, I have done numerous visits across the country and in D.C. I've probably done over 100 legislative visits, and everyone hears the name MGI Pharma, so they all think of one vision that comes to mind. They think of large pharma. And I think we'll give you a story here today that's very different than what a lot of people think about when they hear the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmaceutical industry, for good and bad, is always in the crosshairs in the legislative bodies across the country and in Capitol Hill. But I hope the interaction we have with you today gives you a sense that there are companies who do business very differently at times. And are in different stages within the growth of a pharmaceutical company, and I think the story you'll hear today will prove that to you. Next to me, I have Dave Moline. He is the Senior Director of Corporate and Government Affairs. He's going to walk through our corporate presentation for you, and then at the end, I'll take over with a couple of additional slides I want to talk to you about. And then hopefully we'll have some time. I have a brief 7-minute video. You know, being a former staffer and here and being a former lobbyist for different organizations, I know how much you guys like to not hear from lobbyists and hear from patients. This is a patient video that we put together at our national sales meeting last year. I think you'll find it very informative for you. And lastly, you have a packet in front of you, which has a variety of information in front of it. It has the corporate presentation, which Dave will go through. It has some brochures about our products and some of the patients we're looking to serve. So if you have any questions about that at the end or during, feel free and ask. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll...
Mr. Frost, I have one question. Did you learn that the presentation by the real people was more important when you were dealing with the little kids?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. So, but again, thank you for your time. We look forward to the interaction with you here today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dave.
Well, very good. As Ray said, I'm Dave Moline, and it's a pleasure, Mr. Chair and committee, to be with you this morning. And really our purpose in being here today is just to try to give you an idea of how a Minnesota-born company 27 years ago has gone through a whole lot of iterations, a whole lot of business strategies, and frankly is kind of on the cusp of being a somewhat, successful company in the biopharmaceutical industry here in the state of Minnesota. And as it stands right now, there are not a lot of other examples. I think it's important as we talk to you this morning that we just keep that in mind and talk about what some of the key ingredients are to really build a successful pharmaceutical company. So with that said, just give you a brief corporate overview. We call ourselves, and really our vision is to be a biopharmaceutical company focused in the cancer area and in the acute care area. Biopharmaceutical may be somewhat of a new term. If you think of pharmaceutical, probably people have a lot of different things that come to your mind. I guess the way I would describe that is it's really making drugs through chemistry. So if you can all think back to a chemistry class you may have had in the past, that's really the principles by which drugs are made. Biology, though, or biotech in this case, on the other hand, is really trying to use biological processes to make drugs or to use them on the agricultural side or the industrial side. It's, I guess I would call maybe pharma is the old and bio is the new. Well, being that we've been in business in Minnesota for 27 years, we are somewhat old as a company in our industry. But we have been growing recently, and a lot of that has had to do with our focus as being a biotechnology company. And I want to talk about that as well. But our business strategy is really about acquiring assets, about acquiring products, acquiring companies that are focused in the cancer area, and that's where we started. And this has not been the case all along, and I'll talk about the history of the company as well. But then we have a capable research and development organization, and then a capable commercialization organization here in the North America continent. But really why we are doing this and where we're focused, and I interact with cancer patients every single day. The drugs that we're developing, many of them are orphan drugs, smaller disease states, but they have an impact on patient lives. And that's really what our focus is and what the associates at MGI are all about. So talking about the history, this was a very successful spin-out of the University of Minnesota 27 years ago in 1979. At that time, our customers were the farmers. We had a corn seed, which was herbicide resistant, which we sold, and we still received some very small royalties on that particular product. And we had a canine Lyme's disease vaccine, I guess probably before they were popular, but that was a focus for the company as well. So we really focused in the bioagriculture area for 15 years. And I can tell you, at that time, Molecular Genetics Incorporated was doing cutting-edge research. It was the best in the country, maybe some of the best in the world. Well, the founders of the company at that time felt that was the quickest way to get to human health and be a successful human health company. It may not have been the best decision from that standpoint, but a lot of great work was done early on, and strong collaboration still exists with us and the University of Minnesota. Then in the early 90s, we shifted more to really of a specialty pharma model, and we focused on small orphan drug disease states. And we had a capable R&D organization, and they actually were able to develop a product called Salagen. If you've ever had friends that have gone through radiation for head and neck cancer, they get a very dry mouth. The product was developed to treat that particular problem. It doesn't affect a lot of patients, but the patients that it does affect is very, very debilitating. So we were able to get that product through the FDA regulatory process and actually approved in two indications back in the mid-90s. And that was really the fuel for growth for MGI through the 90s. There was new management that came in early 2000, and we really said, we've got some tremendous assets from an R&D standpoint, and we have a commercial organization in the U.S. And there's tremendous need in the cancer area. That is where we're going to focus. And it was with that focus we went forward, knowing that we had to really bring products in. And that's kind of the story of MGI, is how we've gone out and acquired products and acquired companies and built the organization. And we'll talk a bit about that. So starting in 2000, we had a couple of small acquisitions, Hexalin, which is a product for ovarian cancer from MedImmune. And then the biggest acquisition that we've had is a product called Aloxi. If you've known people that have gone through chemotherapy treatment, nausea and vomiting is one of the most debilitating side effects. We licensed this product actually from a Swiss company, and more of a clinical development organization, and worked with them to bring that to the market in the U.S. That really became a big driver for us, as I'll share with you. Then we acquired three companies on September 1st of 2004. We acquired a company based in Boston. They had biologics capabilities, so they would allow us to have more expertise in the biotechnology area. That was called Zykos. And then we acquired another company in the New Jersey area, which was called Aisin. That was a product for chemotherapy-induced mouth sores. So, again, very, very debilitating and a very small disease state. And lastly, we acquired a product called Dacogen, which was for a type of leukemia. Now, all of these products were in development. They still needed to have clinical testing done on humans. So our organization took those and, in many cases, brought them to Minnesota, and we had a tremendous influx of new talent. We hired many people in the state from some of our friends and other organizations, and we brought many other people into the state to develop these products. And we'll talk about where those products have gone. And lastly, we acquired a company called Guilford Pharmaceuticals in the Baltimore area. This brought more R&D capability, a manufacturing capability that we did not have. And so right now we operate as really three business structures or business units. Bloomington, Minnesota is our home, is our corporate headquarters. We have a Baltimore facility and a Boston facility. So as I was mentioning, these three locations, if I could take you back to when I joined the organization, it was about 75 or 80 associates, and this was in 2000. Today we have nearly 650 associates. We had about 20 or 25 in Bloomington back in 2000. We have approaching 250 today in Bloomington. So we've had about a 10x growth in terms of jobs here in the state, both from people that we've hired and people that we've brought into the state, and it's something we plan to obviously continue. So as I said, we're focused in oncology or cancer and acute care. And when I say acute care, it's really more of a hospital focus. We're talking about products that can be used to aid in surgeries or aid in other difficult procedures where somebody needs to be hospitalized. And we'll talk about a few of those. But we actually have three products on the market now, which all have been approved fairly recently. Aloxi was through the Swiss acquisition. Gliadel came to us from the company in Baltimore that we acquired. And Dacogen was a product we acquired from a California-based company. And we'll talk in more detail on each of these. But I think the point is, as I talk about each of these products, many of them have international homes. Some have U.S. homes. Some are from California. Some are from Boston. Some are even from here in Minnesota. But we've taken all these products because they can make an impact for patients, and we essentially have brought them to Minnesota for a period of time to develop them, get them through the regulatory process, and now in many cases they're being sold all over the U.S. and with some of our partners worldwide. So the growth for MGI was really acquisitions early on. Now it's clearly R&D. We have R&D infrastructure in Minnesota, in Maryland, and in Massachusetts. Our focus from a commercialization standpoint is really in North America. We're very, very capable in the U.S. in terms of working with healthcare professionals, working with patient organizations, working with just the big cancer centers, NCI cancer centers, NIH, et cetera. We don't have a lot of competencies outside of the U.S. right now. I'll talk about some of the partnerships that we've made with other larger companies for some of our products. But clearly our future is growing to the rest of the world. In terms of building a leading biopharmaceutical company, which is really what we're about, there's lots of key ingredients. We talked about the focus areas. We will never be a big pharma company. We have no desire or intent to be. We're a cancer company and we're an acute care focused company. We'll never be big in terms of number of associates, or our revenue won't be huge. I guess the key thing that differentiates MGI is the disease states. You know, when you talk about orphan drugs, you're talking about very small patient populations with high unmet needs. Having worked in a big pharma company in my past and working on business development committees, you'd bring products forward that had to reach a hurdle rate. Back in the mid-90s for a big pharma company, that hurdle rate was about $500 to $600 million. Unless you could not find a product that, that reached that, the executives didn't really care. The challenging thing in oncology, as it was a fledgling market, is there weren't that many products that were that big back in the mid-90s. So it was hard to grow an oncology business in a big pharma company. So many of us that had this experience that came to MGI in early 2000 and have come since then have really had that training and that perspective, but knowing that you can make a difference in a smaller company like MGI Pharma, and that's what we try to do every day. So we've built the organization. We've focused on capitalizing on our R&D capabilities. We've got a capable commercial organization. And we are a publicly traded company. We're traded on the NASDAQ. Although we've been unprofitable for 27 years since we basically were incorporated, we're on the cusp of being profitable. To put that into context, there are about 1,500 biopharmaceutical companies in the U.S. About 300 are publicly traded. And between 2 and 3 dozen are actually profitable. So MGI is a Minnesota-based company that's been in business for 27 years. We're just about there. Now, when I talk about profitable, it's in relative terms, talking about a few million dollars. But it's been a long road, and that is an important milestone because we do have shareholders. But we need to be open and honest about that as well. So let's talk about commercial products. The real driver for MGI is we've grown from, you know, roughly 70 associates to almost 650.
Could I interrupt you just for a moment? We've got a question. Representative Bird?
Bird, yeah. There you go. Is this Mr. Frost that's speaking at the moment? Or Mr. Malin?
Mr. Malin.
Malin, okay. Mr. Chairman, having been a business owner myself and dealt a little bit with risk-reward thing, I'm fascinated with the business model. Is it okay to ask a few questions along those lines? And I think it may serve a useful purpose for the committee as a larger entity. May I?
I think that's just fine. But before we start with some questions, did you want to take questions as they come up, or do you prefer to take them at the end?
Whatever your desire is, Mr. Chair. I mean, it might
right
be
back in my lap. Okay, go ahead. That's been feared.
It's easier now because you don't want to forget them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and this is relevant to this the phase of the discussion you were in. One thing that we consider on this Biosciences and Emerging Technologies Committee is what motivates people to do this stuff. I mean, it's fascinating, and I'm sure if you found kids that love to play with the chemistry set when they were kids, these are the kind of people you'd want to hire. Because there is this personal human reward in doing something well and discovering new stuff that does good for people as a whole. But you just mentioned a fascinating factoid, 27 years of unprofitability for a private company. Wow, where can I find those investors to sign up with me when I'm out of here? But why? What's motivating?
You were planning to announce it here.
Not at the moment, Mr. Chair. But seriously, though, I know we talk about research and development money, and I noticed that you acquired R&D capacity in Massachusetts and Maryland. Maybe let's start with this discussion first, because it might lead in just a brief moment to the whole capitalization structure and who your investors are and why. You bought R&D off the East Coast, and as opposed to growing it here. Did it just work out that way? Was that a deliberate plan, or is that sort of what you find in the marketplace? It's easier for R&D there instead of here, and why?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I guess when you talk about R&D, you talk about you've got discovery R&D, which is before, you know, products ever in man. Basically trying to understand, you know, could they possibly be effective in man? Are they safe? And when I say man, I'm talking about mankind, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then you have clinical development. As a product moves in, it's being tested. There's phase one, phase two, and phase three development. So early on, you're looking for, you know, particularly on oncology, you don't typically use placebo. I mean, you test on people that have active disease. So you're trying to see early on, does it have any activity, and trying to find the right dosage, you know, one that's tolerable for people. And then as you move on in that clinical development path, you try to hone in on a particular disease state, you know, whether it's type of leukemia or lung cancer, ovarian cancer, et cetera. So you get your patient population down. And once you have that, and once you have credible results that you can interact with FDA on, you move into a broader phase three study, either one or two studies, and you try to prove that once again, and then go through the regulatory process. So in terms of R&D and, I guess, acquiring those type of assets, we have very solid collaborations with the U of M, with Mayo here in Minnesota. We have collaborations with other academic centers, Johns Hopkins, MD Anderson, Memorial Sloan Kettering. I mean, really the big cancer centers around the country, we have good working relationships with. In terms of acquiring assets, if you're going to acquire a preclinical product, probably a university is a great place to look. And we do that when we have opportunities. Our business model, though, when we started back in 2000, was to acquire late-stage products. So products that had already been through a lot of even the human testing.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to acquire products where some of the risk had been taken out, because our capability was, you know, basically finishing up the clinical development, working with FDA, and then getting on the market and selling. So we tried to acquire assets that had that profile, that were cancer products either that treated cancer or that were what we call supportive care agents, treated the side effects of chemotherapy, the nausea and vomiting, the drop in blood counts, you know, hair loss, those type of things. So that's really been our focus. So as you narrow it down and say, well, we want to try to find a nausea and vomiting product, you basically go and look and find where those assets might be. Some might be in Minnesota. One we found happened to be in Switzerland. You know, it was a product that was discovered in Palo Alto, California, at a company called Syntex. Syntex was acquired by Roche Pharmaceuticals, which is a large European organization. They had no interest in cancer at the time, so the product sat on the shelf. So the Swiss-based company, when Roche is getting rid of products, they bought it back in the mid-90s. They did the clinical development. In prior life, myself and others had focused in this nausea and vomiting area at a big pharma company. We knew this product, so we got to MGI and we went and found it.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add a couple of things there to your point about 27 years, I think that's a great question. And in my previous life, when I worked for the association, the Biotech Association of the State, that's the message we really tried to give folks. And that's what, in my early comments when I started out here, to give you guys a different sense of what the pharmaceutical world is than what you typically hear. At least since MGI became a focused company in the pharmaceuticals in the early 90s, you know, 15 years ago, if you will, or 14, it's not uncommon at all to find companies in the pharmaceutical space that are in the biotech world to take this long to get to profitability. Not uncommon at all. The point that Dave made, I just want to reiterate it, is that the biotech industry, there's about 1,500 privately held companies. About 300 or so of those are traded, publicly traded. Only about 2 to 3 dozen of those 300 are profitable, and that's in the biotech space. You know, I don't want that message to get lost on you. That's a key thing when we talk about the biotech space, which is a little bit than the traditional pharmaceutical space. It is not atypical at all for companies to take a very long... And the fact of the matter is some companies may never get profitable because what happens is simply
Big Pharma, rightfully so, comes in and buys that company because that company has developed a few products in a pipeline that that Big Pharma company realizes is of value, and they just simply come in and purchase it because that company is going through such a burn rate of money, if you will, that at some point in time the investors look and say, we got to make some money here, and we have to look for partnerships with others. But it's a great question, and no one to think, at least since MGI became a pharmaceutical-focused company, it's not uncommon at all.
Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging the question, and I think it's important for members of this committee to hold that thought, that perspective on motivation and how the business is actually working. It sounds to me at some point the profit motive must come in because we know we have to have a profit somewhere someday when the purchase actually takes place. Maybe that's where the cash out is. But I'm not even sure why it's important. My instincts just tell me this is an important perspective for us to have as we listen to this discussion some more. Maybe I better not ask any more questions right now about that.
Well, I've got actually one question right now and one at the end. Mr. Foss, you keep talking Big Pharma and throwing that out. Could you define that? Is Big Pharma two companies or three companies or...
You know, Dave helped me out on this. I can give you names of you know, it's really what the stock market does. The largest Big Pharma companies, I think just about in rank order, is Pfizer's the largest. When you hear pharma, I think the second is Johnson & Johnson. The third is GlaxoSmithKline. Merck is also very large. I'm not sure where they might be in the ranking. Bristol-Myers Squibb. And then in the biotech space, again, it's defined by the market. The biotech space, the largest biopharmaceutical companies, number one is Amgen, which is a company out of Thousand Oaks in California. The second is a company called Genentech, which is also out of California. I think the third is either Genzyme, Biogenitech company out of Massachusetts. The fourth, I think, is a company called Genzyme, also out of Massachusetts. And the fifth, I think, is either a company called Chiron or a MedImmune company out of Maryland. But the traditional pharma is the very large companies that we all heard about. Roche is another one. But that's defined by the public markets.
So just to clarify, when you throw the term big pharma out, you're talking somewhere in the area of a dozen or less companies.
Probably, yeah. That's probably fair.
About right, yeah. Did you have a question?
Just to follow up, I've been kind of struggling with some of the same comments that Representative Beard made a moment ago, and part of me, I guess, feels comforted to know that Big Pharma doesn't run everything and that there are companies who are specializing and making sure that the research, as universities do, the research in specific areas and orphan drugs and a number of those others continues. And I'm wondering... as we think about this, how does the announcement this morning that I think Pfizer is laying off 10,000 employees, and part of the rationale that I heard was because they are unable to make a profitability on something they had kind of put their eggs in a basket and it didn't work out, how does that impact the smaller companies, and do you pick up some of these drugs, or is there any impact at all?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question, and Dave and I'll take a piece of it on this. We have an example later on in our presentation about a drug very similar to what Pfizer just undertook. And for those who don't know, Pfizer was in a very late-stage clinical trial with a drug they were hoping to bring to market, and they had to pull it from the clinical trial because it wasn't meeting the endpoints, the efficacy that they were looking for. We actually have a great example of that. You know, the effect on Pfizer's 10,000 employees, as we heard, the effect on MGI is a little bit different than that, but we'll talk about that, how it affects a small company, too.
And I think as Ray is, I guess, really drawn, you know, some contrast between a company like MGI Pharma or other biopharmaceutical companies and Big Pharma, as I talked about, the hurdle rates are much higher. So this particular product, which will not make it to market now, they were expecting well in excess of $1 billion or $2 billion in sales. As companies grow to be that large, you have to have revenues that are continuing to feed the engine, the R&D engine. Mm-hmm. And pharma companies do, you know, some fabulous research and development. And many of the products that Big Pharma brings to market are actually biotechnology products that they acquire from companies like ours. So there's some parallels there, but if you think about a big pharma company, typically they're going to focus on all the big disease states. They're in cardiovascular medicine, they'll be in GI medicine, they'll be in oncology and allergy, et cetera. Biopharmaceutical companies typically focus in smaller disease states or in one or two disease states and in orphan drugs.
Continue. Thank you.
Very good. So, as I was talking about the Loxi injection, this is a product for chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. It was the product that came to Minnesota from Switzerland, and this was a fourth entrant to a market. Our competitors are all big pharma companies, as a matter of fact. Sanofi Aventis, Roche, and GlaxoSmithKline, all large multi-billion dollar companies. At the time this product was approved by the FDA in late 2003, we had probably about 150 associates and probably about $30 million in revenue, which is not a lot to compete against the big boys in this particular case. This product was clinically differentiated. It works very differently than those other products that are on the market. You may have heard of Zofran or Ansemet or Kytrol if you've ever had friends that have experienced surgeries or gone through chemotherapy. Aloxia is different because these type of drugs are administered 30 minutes prior to somebody getting chemotherapy. The first generation products that the big pharma companies had, they work for about 16 to 18 hours. Chemotherapy works and gives you nausea and vomiting for several days. So with the older generation products, you have to take oral follow-up therapy. I don't know if any of you have had nausea and vomiting recently, but taking pills is pretty tough. So they weren't very effective. So we had a situation here where we had a superior product. We went head-to-head in the clinical trials versus the two market leaders, and we were shown to be statistically superior. FDA recognizes that, fourth product on the market. You know, this little company in Minnesota with not a lot of assets, but we had a product that was clinically different. We became the market leader in just over 12 months. So I think this product allowed us then to execute on our other business strategy, which was to acquire the Boston-based company and the Baltimore-based company and the other products that we did. So, but the point I want you to take away is if you have a friend or colleague that is going through chemotherapy treatment, tell them about Aloxi because it's one injection that works for 5 days. And it's very, very effective. My mother-in-law has taken it, and she's had fabulous results. So that's more of an aside, but it's a very good product. Dacogen is a product. You know, it's called a hypomethylating agent. I won't get into the details of that. It's a product that treats a type of leukemia called myelodysplastic syndrome. There's about 20,000 to 30,000 patients that are affected by MDS every year here in the U.S. It's an orphan drug. This is a product that we acquired from Supergen, which is a San Francisco-based company. We acquired that. We were able to work through the regulatory process with FDA, and that product was approved earlier this spring. And it is a substantial product. About 18 months ago, there were no products on the market for MDS. Now there's three. And again, as I said, it's a relatively small disease state, so there's two other peer companies like ours that have brought products to market in this area, and now these patients have hope. So, a very important disease state. We're developing it not only in the MDS area, but it works for other areas like acute myeloid leukemia, chronic myelogenous leukemia, and also in solid tumors, which say solid tumors, your lung cancers, your breast cancers, ovarian cancers, etc. So we're investing more money into the development of this particular product, and we have to go back to FDA and get approval in these areas as well. And this year we consummated a worldwide licensing arrangement with the company of J&J's as well. So they're our worldwide partner.
Let me just add a point to that, if I could, Mr. Chair, real quickly. Kind of to your question before, a little bit about the connection of big pharma and biopharmaceutical, smaller one. It's very important, though, for us as a company to have access to large pharma, to have access to a Johnson & Johnson or whomever who shares some of our same goals around the markets we're looking at. Because we would be less profitable for a much longer time if we wanted to sell our drug outside of the U.S. We'd have to build up a commercialization outside of the U.S.
that would cost a lot of money. That would take us a significant amount of time, probably longer to get us to profitability if we wanted to set up a commercialization process in Europe. So we go to Big Pharma, who has that money, has that ability to form a partnership where they can bring our drug package in to MDS patients there. Because otherwise, if we didn't do that, MDS patients outside the U.S. would not access that drug. So those partnerships, to underline the importance of those partnerships for a company of our size that doesn't have commercialization abilities outside the U.S., it's very important.
Now, our last commercial product is a product called Gliadel.
Cheers.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a typical kind of channel partnership relationship. And I understand that your investors are waiting a long time for profitability. Is the motivation to just wait for either the right product to hit and to get acquired by a big company? Is it sort of that? Or is it a revenue stream that they're looking for? And how frequently do the big pharma companies acquire companies like yours? Because, for example, just in this Dacogen, why engage in a channel partnership when they could acquire you if you have other assets that look worthwhile? And is that what your investors are looking for ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And I think that as a biopharmaceutical company, we're kind of a mid-tier company right now. We've got a very broad investment base, and we have 95% plus institutional ownership. So here are your Fidelity funds and your T. Rowe Price and probably many of the ones you're personally familiar with. On Wall Street, we're seen as a consolidator. You're either a consolidator or you're will be consolidated at some point, I guess. And I think as I've interacted with folks in Wall Street, they kind of put you in two buckets. And they put their confidence in management based upon being able to execute on a business strategy. And we said early on in 2000, we were going to become a leading biopharmaceutical company. And we've been able to live up to that promise based on the assets we've acquired, number one. So you have to be able to do that. And then you have to be able to execute on those acquisitions. I think Dacogen is a good example where we acquired it from a company that Dacogen was actually discovered back in the 60s. So there had been clinical work going on with that product for a long, long time. MGI was able to take it over the finish line. And now is successfully selling it in the U.S. And we have this partnership in the rest of the world. So does that answer your question?
Well enough for now. Thank you.
Okay. Ready. Mr. Chairman, can I continue?
Yeah. Please do.
Our third commercial product is called Gliadel. This is a product for a fairly rare form of brain cancer called glioblastoma multiforme. It's a very small disease state. This product has been on the market for 10 years. Last year, we treated 2,100 patients. 2,100 patients that, if Gliadel had never been brought to market, wouldn't have hope because it's the only product that treats this type of brain cancer right after their surgery. So as someone goes in for brain surgery, the tumor is removed, and in the cavity, Gliadel, which is basically a chemotherapy with a delivery system, it's a wafer delivery system, which slow releases chemotherapy into the space where the tumor once occupied. So the drug is in there for a period of a few days until the other chemotherapy and radiation can start. So it's a very, very important product for neurosurgeons, for brain cancer patients. It's a relatively small product, even for a company like ours, but it's very, very important as we interact with brain cancer patients and the patient advocacy groups in this area. So that is our product. So let me just switch focus here and talk just briefly about our product pipeline. And the thing I'll draw you to here is, as you look at this long list with some different names, I'm going to just take you through each of them quickly because I'm going to tell you where they came from. That Aquaban product, the product for sedation, that came from the Baltimore acquisition. Aloxi injection for PONV or postoperative nausea and vomiting, that came from Switzerland. Aloxi oral, again, from Switzerland. Sephoris came from New Jersey. Dacogen came from California. Amlimidine came from Boston. Again, the other Dacogen products, California. Irofulven, collaboration that we have with UC San Diego. Zyke 300, again, Boston. And the last two programs are actually from Johns Hopkins, a collaboration we have with them in Baltimore. I guess my point in covering this, and I'll get into a few in more detail, these are all products that MGI has acquired, brought capabilities to Minnesota to further their clinical development and bring them to market. So in terms of growing this company, and Representative Behrens had asked a question about the investment community, they're always looking for what's next. And this gives you just a brief snapshot of really what's next for MGI Pharma. We have several late-stage products. When I say late-stage, they're last phase of clinical development, soon to move to market, we hope. And you can see Dacogen. Although it's on the market, we have other pivotal trials ongoing. And you can see the peak sales there. These other products are in their pivotal trials, so phase three. And just to note here that one patient in a phase three study costs us $25,000. You know, typically, phase three studies are several hundred patients to several thousand patients. So they're very, very expensive to do. And lastly, Ray had referred to Sephoris. Sephoris was a product we acquired from Aisin, which was a New Jersey-based company. It was a company for chemotherapy-induced mouth sores. This is a product that we applied to the FDA for regulatory approval, and we got an approvable letter. There's varying stages of what that means. In this case, we have to do another pivotal trial. The cost of that pivotal trial will probably be anywhere between $15 and $30 million. We acquired the company, and that was quite expensive to do that. The peak market for this product, being $100 million, may seem like a lot, but unlike other manufacturing industries, a lot of our expenses are accrued in arrears. So where products have a 17-year patent life, it'll take 8 to 10 years on average to get those products to market, and then you basically recoup your investment, hopefully get a little bit of profit, and put the rest back into R&D. We're kind of at the cusp with Sephoris. You know, we had hoped for an approval, even though we hit our clinical endpoints, had statistical superiority to the comparator, FDA didn't approve it. So we just point this out that it's not always the success stories. This is a really difficult business situation that we're facing right now, where we've made the investment, and we don't know if we'll get it over the finish line, and even if we do, if we'll be able to get the money back on it.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dave, when you talk potential peak sales, those are annual sales, I take it.
Actually, they would, at peak, typically talk about peak sales being 4 to 5 years on the market.
Wow, and that's over a 4 or 5 year period, that's your peak.
Correct.
And the patent is 17 years, Mr. Chair, if I may. 17 years, when does that start? The day you discovered or the day you actually hit the market?
Yeah, it's in the discovery phase. It depends. I mean, every patent situation is handled a little bit differently, but basically it's at discovery.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know that. I just want the committee to kind of be aware of the pressure you're under then. If you're going to take 6 or 7 years or more to get approval once you get the patent, your actual window of recouping the investment in this thing is only 8 or 10 years then.
That's true.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, to highlight your point, which you stole my thunder, but thank you. No. going back to what I said originally, a differentiated story, if you will, from what people typically hear about, whatever the size of the pharmaceutical company is, you hear about blockbuster drugs. You've all heard about the statins, you know, the Lipitors, and their billions of dollars, and you hear about other drugs. Not everyone is focused in that success. We're talking peak sales of Dacogen, $250 million. You know, when people debate, whether it's in the halls of state legislatures or at their dining room table, they think, oh, the money that the large pharma companies are making, billions and billions of dollars. You can add up all our drugs right there. And unfortunately, Sephoris right now is not on market. And they just come to $1 billion, and that's at their peak. Mm. That's at their peak. So if we fumble a little bit and don't hit that peak, that's a difference. And to the story about Sephoris that Dave talked about, that was one of the things we were going to highlight, Deb, to your question about what Pfizer just went through, and we just went through it, because that approvable letter that we received from the FDA came in October. So what we were doing as a company, we were gearing up for commercialization of Sephoris and building budgets around expecting revenue
of some portion of that $100 million in 2007. And the reason we were expecting is we weren't trying to be presumptive on our part, but we hit the endpoint that the FDA asked us to do. We showed clinical superiority, and I want to focus on that. We showed them what the drug can do, and one thing Dave didn't mention to you was oral mucositis, which this would have been indicated for. There is no drug on the market for anyone who suffers from oral mucositis right now. Mm. So not only would this be an orphan drug, small patient population, if someone you know suffers from oral mucositis right now, there's nothing the doctor can do for them other than give them painkillers. Mm. That's the only thing they can do for them. So we worked with the FDA, we hit the clinical endpoint, and we thought, wow, not only are we going to get revenue, let's be clear, we're going to make money on this, but finally patients are going to have something out there for them. So not only were we disappointed that even though we hit the endpoint that the FDA asked us to do, we're not going to launch that drug, but the calls that we received from patients about that. Patients want access to that drug because they know it's safe. It went through their clinical trials, there was no problems with it. But for whatever reason, the FDA said, you got to do another clinical trial. Now, we have to make that business decision to say, are we going to invest another $30 million, potentially $15 to $30 million into a drug that has peak sales of 100? We already purchased the company for X millions of dollars. Are we going to do it? Sure, our balance sheet, to be very open, our balance sheet will suffer if we say no. But the people will ultimately suffer. If you get oral mucositis, you got nothing on the market for you. There's nothing there.
Mr. Frost or Mr. Melvin, I just want to be clear on your peak sales. When you say peak sales, is that after your five-year climb to what you're calling peak, is that $250 million of sales per year, or is that cumulative over the 12-year life of your patent, usable patent?
Mr. Chair, good question. It's annual sales in the fourth or fifth year on the market.
Thank you.
So if I may continue?
Please do.
Just to highlight a couple of our key products that are in late-stage development, Aquaban Injection is a product for mild to moderate sedation. So if you think about patients that may have undergone a colonoscopy procedure or a bronchoscopy or just minor surgery, it could be plastic surgery, et cetera, this is a better drug to sedate patients. So in the past where you may have gone in for one of these procedures and your spouse or loved one or friend has driven you to that procedure, this is a type of drug where you may not have to have that in the future because it will sedate you more quickly and it'll wake you up and you'll be more clear-headed.
So are you going to provide that for session?
That's up to the chair.
That should be a beta
for
stuff.
Free. But it's a product that takes us into this acute care area. We've been really focused in the cancer area. This is really more of a hospital-based drug. It's a good fit for Aloxi for post-operative nausea and vomiting. If you've undergone different surgical procedures, in many cases, you'll feel sick. Aloxi works in that area, too, but we have to prove it to the FDA, and that phase 3 trial is ongoing right now as well. So Aquaban is a good partner there. We expect to file the new drug application, which is really all the data the FDA needs to review the product, and we expect to do that the first half of this year. And then amylimogene. Amylimogene is a biotechnology product that we acquired from the Zykos acquisition. That was that Boston-based company. And this is now our MGI Pharma Biologics facility. The woman who runs that company is a Harvard PhD, and she basically discovered this product. And it has a tremendous impact for patients that have high-grade cervical dysplasia, and that disease state leads to cervical cancer. You've probably read a lot in the lay press about prophylactic vaccines for HPV. It's a very, very big problem for adolescents and for, frankly, many women and men who are much older than that. Prophylactic vaccines, when given between the ages of 9 and 13 to girls and to boys, for probably 70% of those patients will hopefully be effective in terms of eradicating human papillomavirus. And that's the hope. But that'll probably take about a generation to fully be effective. And they only really target two of the types of HPV. Our approach with amylimogene, it's a therapeutic. It's a treatment for HPV. So for the men, women, where the prophylactic vaccine is not effective, or for the ones that already have the disease state and progress. The treatment now is called the LEAP procedure. It's a very invasive surgical procedure where the virus is essentially burned or scraped off the cervix. It's very painful, and it's very debilitating, and often women cannot carry pregnancies to term, and there's other complications as well. So you have that choice, or amelinogene is a single shot thought. And based on the clinical results so far, has about the same resolution rate. So it's a big problem. It's a pretty innovative solution, and there's a lot higher science behind this than I could ever pretend to explain to you. But it's a very, very important product for these particular patients. So just to really, conclude my remarks, as you think about the growth of MGI Pharma over the past 27 years, a lot of it has been about trying to find patients where there's unmet needs. We decided to focus on the cancer area primarily. And we focus on relatively small disease states. Orphan drugs, disease states might have, a few tens of thousands of patients. Where big pharma, frankly, just, they could not go because their hurdle rates are too high. We've been reasonably successful so far. We still have a lot to do. There's still a lot of unmet patient need. At this point, we've grown at our Minnesota facility from 20 to 25 associates to upwards of 250. And we hope that if we continue to execute on our business strategy, they can actually add to that growth going forward. So I guess I'll leave you with the comic book Ray and I made earlier. MGI Pharma started in Minnesota in 1979 out of the University of Minnesota. Has separated itself from the other 1,500 biopharmaceutical companies that are in the market, both public and private. Is publicly traded and is really poised and on the cusp of being profitable for the first time in 27 years here in 2007. And we'll continue, obviously, to focus on meeting the unmet patient needs, which has allowed us to be successful. So I'll turn it over to Ray and then look forward to any questions you might have afterwards.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I get the honor of talking to you about some issues that are of concern to us within the legislative halls, not only in Minnesota, but around the country. So heading to the next slide, talking to you just a little bit about some of the hurdles for us. You see it in the slide. I talked about the Sephora example. We already did talk about that because of your previous question. But one of our big concerns is, many times because of the perceptions people have of when they hear the word pharma or pharmaceutical industry, they just think of the big ones many times, and they think of the billion-dollar blockbusters. So for whatever reason, right or wrong, Republicans and Democrats, it's not a partisan issue, have come across many policy initiatives over the last few years that they've put upon the industry, some of which have been good, but many of which have been hurtful or have had adverse effects more to the smaller companies, whether it is additional regulations of clinical trials, which we've debated in here, to kill the elephant, price controls, to talk about additional sales and marketing legislation, and the one that everybody's heard about, because we, to some extent, we've all seen them and we've all had different reactions to them, is DTC legislation and DTC, direct-to-consumer advertising. That is debate not only in state at the state level, but a very hot debate at the national level, and will continue to be. And if I can point you to our next slide, because we don't have to talk about the Sephora's example, because we already did that through some of our question and answer. We as a company last year decided to undertake direct-to-consumer advertising. That direct-to-consumer advertising is, like us, is very, very targeted. We are not on television, but we are in women's health magazines across the country. These women's health magazines go right into doctors' offices, oncologists specifically. And there were a variety of reasons why we as a company undertook this initiative. And let me say, one of the big reasons was, as Dave said, we are the fourth entrant with Aloxi into the 5-HT3 market, and we compete with some of the biggest pharmaceutical companies in the world, Sanofi, Aventis, Roche, and GlaxoSmithKline.
For example, the last time I had heard, so please don't quote me, but somewhere in a neighborhood of about 9 to 9,500 sales reps work for GlaxoSmithKline across the country. Now, they all don't work on one specific product because GlaxoSmithKline has numerous products in the market, but many of those 9,500 work on the drug that we compete against called Zofran. MGI Pharma has about 150 salespeople across the country. They probably have 150, I'm just guessing, in California, possibly more. So again, please don't quote me, we'd have to ask them. We decided because we have a clinically superior drug, not because I tell you, as they said, but because the FDA label tells you, it is the only drug that in that 5-HT3 class that is indicated for acute and delayed nausea and vomiting. We said we're going to go directly to the patient. We actually want patients to read in magazines or other places that this drug is better for them, and we do want them to go to their doctor and say, we hear this drug's better, and we want to try it. That was our goal with this. So when folks, and we all know the ads we're talking about, the Cialis, the Levitra, we've all seen them, and we've had different reactions to them. But just know that there are smaller companies that actually DTC is very much a part of our strategy as we move forward to try and get to the patients, because we can't compete. Even though we're bringing differentiated market drugs to market, we all want to believe that doctors, in Utopia, we all want to believe doctors will make the best clinical decisions for you. And for the most part, that absolutely does happen. But just like in every profession, whether it's teachers, firemen, cops, legislators, not everyone always does the best thing. We've all seen that. We've all had personal experience with that. So we have decided to undertake this, and if the legislatures across the country, if Capitol Hill and Congress decides to do away with DTC advertising, that's going to have a negative impact on us, because it's going to make it harder for us to compete in this market that we're trying to be successful in. So that's just one example. Another example is something that you may even undertake this year in Minnesota, is additional sales and marketing legislation, and what the goal is there is to really find out what pharmaceutical companies are spending on doctors' lunches and variety of things in states. And to some extent, I would not even argue with the intent of it. I understand the intent of what you're trying to do, so I wouldn't argue the philosophy of it. But what I would argue is that the impact that you think you're having as a policymaker, you're going, you know, we're trying to really get a better understanding of the big pharma and what those guys are doing, how much money they're spending, and what the relationship is to the cost of their drug. I'm just guessing again. If Pfizer had it, you know, it's different now because they just laid off 10,000 people. But if Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson had to add a couple of people in their compliance department to fill out these forms and make sure they're hitting the law in Maine and Vermont and all these places, it's probably not that big of a deal for them. At MGI, we have a total of about 600 associates. I can tell you this is my first year going through our budgeting process this year. I'm sure every company goes, but it was an unbelievably thoughtful and at times painful process, because as a company that doesn't have a ton of money and a company that is not yet profitable, we actually, you know, fight over FTE growth. And the very fair discussion in our company is, what value is this person who we're going to add to our associate base, what value are they going to have? And when I have to stand in a room and look our CEO and others and our board in the eye and tell them that the value of this person that I need to hire is absolutely zero. This person will add no value to MGI. This person will add no value to our products. This person will add zero value to the patients. They have no value whatsoever. And they say, well, why are we hiring them? Well, because we got to fill out these nuisance forms that these states want us to fill out. And it actually does take away, in a company our size, it takes away from some other things we have to do. So I just wanted you to leave you with the impact. And again, we can debate another kind of philosophy of it. But they actually really do have real impact, some of the things you do on some smaller companies. So those are just two examples. We can talk about more if you'd like. But I think the Sephora's example that we talked about here, about trying to bring a drug to market and the DTC and why we've undertaken those things, even though they are controversial, we know they are. But we welcome the opportunity to try and have an open dialogue with you about your concerns and how we can potentially meet, you know, your concerns and work to a compromise on them. So those are just a couple examples. We can take questions, Mr. Chair, if you like, and we can go to the patient video as well.
Well, one of my first questions is, could you tell me how you really feel about that particular issue?
Mr. Chair, I have now the pleasure of having three people on my team this year, but last year I had responsibility for all 50 states and Capitol Hill. So I really didn't do a real good job because it was impossible. But of all the visits I had, it was very funny because, you know, our name is MGI Pharma. So when I would call up for a visit, mostly on Capitol Hill, I would walk into the meeting and people already had this perception of me going, oh, I thought you were, you know, pharma. I thought you were a big company. So it took about 5 minutes of the meeting to get through the through that public perception of me. And everyone, Republican, Democratic, like, after they heard the story, they said, you know, this is really what we need to hear. This is the stuff we need to hear, because the fact of the matter is we only do think about a lot of the big ones when we're making policies, and we don't know about some of the effects of some of the small ones. So it's a thing that I've dealt with a lot in the past year, so apologize.
you don't get a lot of blowback from this chair about having strong opinions, as many people know around here. Representative Pepin, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Frost, you may have covered this, and it was perhaps when I stepped out of a room or whatnot, so I apologize if this is a repeat, but I noticed on a couple of slides back, you talked about legislative issues of concern.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, A, was sales and marketing legislation in Minnesota, New Hampshire, Maine, West Virginia, and Vermont. Could you talk a little bit more about what that means?
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Pepin. Thanks for the question. Well, actually, Minnesota has the honor, as we've done in many things, ECFE and other things that Minnesota is very famous for. Minnesota had the first sales and marketing law on the books around the country. And what it is now, it's turned to be that in a given year, very similar to what lobbyists can do with legislators, in a given year, no salesperson, or even myself, no person can spend more than $50 in a calendar year on any practitioner. So that means doctors, that would mean pharmacists, that would mean nurses, people of that nature. So, you know, again, if we wanted to do an ad board or a KOL where you get key opinion leaders in a room and talk about our drugs, we actually can't pick up, like you guys have to deal with the laws we have, we can't pick up their meal if it comes to more than $50 in a given year. We have the ability to spend $49.99 up for them for that entire year. So that's how it is in Minnesota. Now, other states over the last few years, like Maine, West Virginia, the District of Columbia now, New Hampshire, they have reporting laws. They're a little bit differently. They say anything above $25 that you spend on a doctor or on a rarium or things of that nature, it's legal, but we ask that you report it. So when I talk about the compliance stuff, someone actually has to look through all of the expense reports for someone who works, for all of our people who might work up in Maine. They have to go through every expense report and see every lunch above $25 that may have been with a doctor. They have to actually report that, and it goes on to the state of Vermont, West Virginia. It goes on to the Attorney General's website. It's public information. So those are the type of laws that we interact in some other states.
Follow-up?
Yes, Representative Mahoney and Mr. Frost. Do you have some suggested legislation to change that?
Well, you know, we have...
a little ridiculous to me.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, thanks for your question. We have talked about this internally and within the organizations of pharma and bio. You know, maybe there's ways that you can look for exemptions to it, certain size of companies or things of that nature. But, you know, and we can certainly talk more about it. Some other states, like California, what they've simply done is that they've mandated every company that's in the pharmaceutical space simply has a compliance policy, a promotional policy. They have to publish that policy on their website, and anyone can check and call up and say, making sure that we're abiding by it. We don't need to report anything to them, but they're asking that we every year update our promotional policy, which is what our people are governed by, meaning, you know, our promotional policy doesn't allow someone to actually go out and spend $10,000 on one doctor for a meal or $5,000. So we are governed by our own promotional policy, which is something California does. So there are other things that we can certainly talk about, but the DPC one, I couldn't tell you. That's a tough debate. I don't know how to get around that one.
Well, that would be interesting to see what the California does or some of those other states do, and I'm sure, you know, they're not keeping you all that busy, are they, Mr. Frost?
No, not at all.
it would be nice to see some of that if you get a chance.
Well, and let me, to get away from those, which are maybe onerous ones, but, you know, Mr. Chair, people have talked about clinical trials, and we certainly understand when people are trying to regulate, to some extent, clinical trials more, because we have heard of adverse events within clinical trials. Unfortunately, some patients do die, and they might not have enough information. And we're sympathetic to that. That is a very big issue, but know that if there's any type of big reaction, if you will, to something happening in one clinical trial, if you make it harder, and sometimes that might be necessary, but know the effect. Dacogen, for example, just to give you real-life examples, Dacogen, as Dave said, the patient population for Dacogen in a given year is about 20 to 30,000 patients. If you do a clinical trial and you need to find thousands of patients to do a clinical trial, when you're trying to bring orphan drugs, now this is just orphan drugs, we're not talking about cholesterol lowering, we're not talking about other things. When you're doing orphan drugs, it's very hard to find those patients. It's extremely hard to find those patients. So if you actually make it harder on us, it becomes that much harder to do it. The patient population, one thing Dave forgot to mention, of that 20 to 30,000 patients, 90% of those 20 to 30,000 patients with MDS are senior citizens. These people are very sick people. They are many of them are in the hospital. Some of them have blood transfusions weekly or daily. Very hard to find those patients. Thankfully, we were able to bring the drug to market. But again, the market dynamics, if there's legislation that tries to make that harder, and again, sometimes it's necessary because we've got to make sure that the patients enrolling in clinical trials have all the information that they need. But there are other things to look at, too.
Representative Ruth, did you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Molina, you were talking about the DTC advertising, and I was just thinking, there's a competitor out there for Aloxi, for example, that we have an anti-nausea drug. Wouldn't it actually help you, rather than having the advertising, if it's a larger company, they're going to have more advertising dollars. So I'm guessing, you know, I thought it might be an advantage to curb some of the advertising, because frankly, they're going to have more money to advertise than a smaller company.
In this particular case, I think you have to look at the disease states and look at the unmet needs and how patients actually get information. If you look at the companies that we compete against, the big pharma companies, they're across, you know, diverse therapeutic areas. You know, they focus their big money on disease states like, you know, cardiovascular medicine, allergies. You see a lot of allergy ads on TV and periodicals, et cetera. They actually focus in this oncology area, but don't do it in such a meaningful way that doesn't allow us to compete. I mean, all of our focus as a company is focused in cancer. All of our focus in the past has been focused on Aloxi. It's our flagship product. Mm-hmm. So we actually are able to essentially have the muscle to compete with them. And because our product is different, it just is another way to get the message to patients, which might not otherwise happen.
And just Mr. Chair, just a piece of information, that ad that you saw up there, and I could put it back if you need to see it, but it is in your packet, that the woman who's on that ad is not an actress. She's actually a cancer patient, two-time survivor, I think, of ovarian, if I'm correct, and brain and breast cancer. So it's not an actress. It's someone who's actually really dealt with cancer two times and beat it. If I might, Mr. Chair, I'd like to play the video. And what the video is, just to be clear, it's not a promotion of MGI by any sense. It's really a story of a patient who takes the story from diagnosis of cancer to her first treatment of chemotherapy to her experience with chemotherapy, and then now where she is in her stage of her life. So it talks about that, if you're willing to see that.
I see no questions at the moment, so why don't you go ahead?
And it's only 6.5 minutes long, so it's not that long.
Hello, everybody. I'm not Marla. Hello, everybody. I'm not Marla, and I'm sitting in the video. I'm okay. No, I'm not an email rep. I'm just a patient. 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And that is correct.
So the next thing he says to me is, you're going to have chemotherapy. And I'm thinking, I don't know about that. Have a water poison, and that's what it is. So the nurses come in, they're all gowned up, and they've got these bags and needles, and I hate needles. So they say, okay, you're going to be here for about 6 hours, and then you can go home, but we want you to hang around for about 2.5 hours afterwards, just to see how you feel. Do like an experiment with you. So they took me all up, we go through this whole thing, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to forget. Touch it. So I get a little heartburn, I touch the other patient, the other bed. I say, can I go home yet? So I go to home, I go to bed, wake up the next day. I don't feel good, but I don't feel really bad. The girlfriend is still hanging up. Day 3, it gets worse. I get up and I'm thinking, oh, I really feel bad. Drink a little water, take a little bath, I'll be fine. I'm not shrinking by the way. Day 4. Day 5, it gets really bad. It's like 29th, 30th of December in Minnesota. It's snowing, it's cold. I really don't want to bother anybody, but I'm starting to throw up. And I throw up for 24 hours. Well, my grandmother was a nurse, and I know enough that if you throw up every 15 minutes for 24 hours, you're really getting dehydrated. So I'm crawling on my hands and knees. And it's now New Year's Day. And I'm thinking, okay, shoot me. Just get up. Get to the hospital. Check me in a room. I'm in the bathroom of my room. Going up, not yet. Doctor comes in, never seen this man before. He's standing behind me asking me questions. I can't answer his questions. I'm going to be throwing up. They put me in bed, hooked me up to all these IVs, you know, more anti-nausea drugs. Don't know what they are, I'm going to tell you. I'm just praying they work. 4 days later, they say, okay. You're hydrated enough, you're not strong enough, you can go home. Okay. So when I went home in the car with my friend and I say, okay, I'm not doing any more of this. You know, what difference does it make? If the treatment kills me or the disease kills me, I'm still dead. So it's kind of quiet for a minute and he says, Mom, you really need to think about that. That's really important. Here we go with round 2. I said, I'm not going to that treatment room with anyone. She grinned at me like, oh, you're such a pain. So I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to have to do just to get this drug that might, I hope, get me through this? So I get my cell phone and I call my insurance company. So I ended up 15 minutes or so to make sure they're not going to give me a pushback either. They were nice guys. Yes, it's covered. So we get done with it, and I'm just crossing my fingers. Please, can this work? So my son comes and picks me up, and I go home, and I'm thinking, okay, let's just wait and see. So we go day one, day two, day three, day four, and day five, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to die. I'm throwing up. I don't feel good by any means. I kind of feel like I'm on the back track. But I didn't throw up. And I fall off. So I waste the next 2 weeks going for round three. And by then, it's a piece of cake. I got my phone. Go in. Hi. Where's my lockpick? Right here. Okay. Got all done. Went through the session. I am getting out of the chair and they're saying, you must be wasting the idea. I'm like, I lost it for me. It's a wonderful. So you go in and get pushed back, you can then call me if you'd like. Whether it's yours or their doctors or pharmacists, if it's their family and they're going through what I went through, they would want somebody to give them something that works and allows to work. Isn't that what you guys are all trying to do, is to tell them and educate them, yes, this drug works. Isn't it scary enough that I have to fight to get a drug to help you through it?
That's it, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your indulgence.
Without any other questions, I've got a couple of comments that I want to make sure I'm on the right track here with. Now, your company is really, in many respects, buying products from other product lines from other companies that have decided they're not, they don't meet their profit projections on that particular drug in many respects. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I guess that's partially true. I think there's different motivations why companies will choose to sell a product or develop it themselves. In the case of most of the companies, either companies that we've acquired or products that we've acquired, in the estimation of their management and investors, for whatever reason, whether they were cash poor, management poor, or critical capabilities in the clinical development area, they just didn't have the right ingredients, whether it was people, money, etc., to get the product over the finish line. And obviously, it's our job as a company to work with these organizations. And most of these collaborations take, a year to a year and a half to actually come to fruition.
So it would be safe to say that if a company like yours didn't exist, those products would still be on the shelf, or your company or a company like you, those products and that video would probably not be shot, or a video similar to that with some of the other drugs.
That's true, Mr. Chairman. Yes.
And then one other question, and we'll go to others. Or one other, I just want to clarify, you tossed around employment numbers of 250 in state and approximately 650 nationwide. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this is all from a company that was started at the University of Minnesota 27-some years ago.
Yeah, in fact, to put it in context, between 1979 and 2000, the company fluctuated between probably 20 associates to a high of maybe 60 or 70. And there were some up years and there were some down years, and in every industry, when you have your down years, you got to reduce expenses. So that did happen some over that time period. But from 2000 forward, our growth trajectory has been from about 70 or 80 total associates to just over 600 associates, and here in the state from roughly 20 to 25 to upwards of 250.
And this is more of a question for Mr. Frost, if I could. Eliminating, you know, the upper management, the CEO, and all the people with initials in front of their names, could you get for me, and maybe I'll share it with the rest of the committee, what the average wage is of your associates in the state of Minnesota?
Sure.
And what I'm just trying to find out is what these type jobs pay as a wage. And obviously you can skew things with the person that's, let's see, you know, Home Depot, that $200 million, you know, makes all those jobs look a lot more profitable than they really are. So I think you understand what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I might, two points of interest that maybe for the committee. Many of you know probably or have interacted with the original founder of the company, one of the original founders. He was, at a university, Dean Charles Muscoplat. He was one of the original founders of molecular genetics. And the second thing, just to note to your point about the salary stuff, at MGI, all 600 and 650 employees are shareholders of MGI as well. So it's a publicly traded company, and everyone down to the lowest person is a shareholder in MGI.
Representative Martin?
Yes, Representative Mahoney and members. First, I want to thank you for the type of work that you do, because I would hate to live in a world where only things that are the most profitable and, you know, reach a large number of people are worked on, because there are many diseases and drugs that are needed to treat those diseases that may have a small market, and they're nonetheless valuable. I personally have just lost my mother last year, and she could have very much used the Zephoris. That was a real issue for her. There was no treatment, and so good for you, and good luck getting that to the market, FDA approved. The question I really have has to do with patents. One of the, and I know patenting is a federal issue, but I'm wondering how it affects the drugs that you choose. You mentioned the one that had been on the shelves forever in Switzerland, and you brought it here. And at some point, patents, I assume, happen along the way. And I know there is a limit. In fact, that was, I think, one of Pfizer's downfalls here was a patent that had expired, and suddenly they lost their market because of generic drugs. How does that sort of thing play into the time that it may take you to go through all these clinical trials, get it approved, and you may only have a short-lived time left on a patent, if I'm understanding the laws correctly? So I'm just wondering how that all plays into what you do.
We can piggyback on it, because they might know more of the specifics around the patent, but that's absolutely true. I mean, we have a patent shelf life of Prolaxy till 2015. So we launched the drug in late 2003, fourth quarter 2003. So we have about 12 years of shelf life for that drug before it goes generic. But the interesting thing about that is, as we said, we're the fourth entrant into that 5-HT3 market, and our biggest competitor, which we had mentioned, Zofran, made by GlaxoSmithKline, that has now gone generic. So even though Aloxi is still on patent, the 5-HT3 market that they compete in has now just gone generic. So we also have, you know, some of those issues. Now, I don't know when the original patent was formulated for Aloxi. We could try and find that out for you. But yes, we have a shelf life till 2015. We have a shelf life on Dacogen till about 7 years from now, I think. About till maybe 2012, I think. So yeah, for Dacogen as an orphan drug, we only have about 7 more years in the U.S. before that goes off patent.
And if I can continue, and that does affect then, as you're talking about how much you anticipate making, and you talk about the peak year being the fifth year, if there's only 7 years left on a patent, that's somewhat limiting as to your profitability on each of these drugs, and I assume they're all somewhat different.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that you're absolutely right. I mean, you're absolutely hitting the point. And, you know, that goes into, you know, the people with the initials in front of their names, Mr. Mahoney, those decisions are left to them because they're much smarter than I am. But, yes, I mean, it's something we have to deal with, certainly.
Just one quick follow-up on that. Just in general, if you have information on generic, I mean, what is there any margin on generics that you guys make? And what, in the industry, what is the, I mean, because it's not as if once the, I'm assuming it's not as if once the patent disappears, you don't make money anymore. It's just that your margin is reduced. Do you have any information on that?
Mr. Chair, if I could address that, please. Representative Thiessen, when products go generic, there's a regulatory process with the FDA. Instead of a new drug application, an abbreviated new drug application is filed, as you might be aware of. Depending upon the type of product or usually the size of the market, generic companies will basically have to prove bioequivalence in most cases for these particular products. And then they'll flood the market. So with the case of Zofran, there are 15-plus generic competitors, so the price drops very, very rapidly. In fact, that product went off patent Christmas Eve of 2006, and the price for that particular product dropped probably 80% in 2 weeks, just to give it a perspective.
I think your question...
And the question is, it dropped 80%, but, and I guess part of it, it goes to whether you've recovered all your R&D in the patent period, but that 80%, is there still a rule, I mean, you have your manufacturing cost is kind of what you're left with at that point. Is there still, I mean, is that, I mean, they would take the product off the market, presumably, if they weren't making any money on it. So is there any kind of industry data on what the profit margin on a generic would be?
It's clearly not our expertise. We don't have generic products. It's not within our business model now or in the future. I can tell you that the margins, from what I know of the industry, are pretty razor thin. I mean, they make their money in the first 3 weeks and months a product goes generic, and they make it on volume.
And you will see a difference within the generic market of, as Dave said, the size of the market. Like for it may have been, I may be wrong, but it might have been Lipitor or one of the statins that went off patent for Pfizer, and they lost there, and because that was maybe an $8 billion-plus market for Pfizer, there were a ton of generics that came in to try and get a piece of that $8 billion market. And Pfizer lost something like maybe 80% very fast of that market. Now, Zofran was doing maybe $800 million, I think. Zofran, the drug we compete against, was doing maybe over $1 billion, but they were doing it within the CINV, chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting market, and the postoperative nausea and vomiting market. Mm-hmm. So the higher the volume for money, the more generics you'll see come in. If it's a lower, you know, because there's just so much competition, you'll see less ANDAs filed.
Well, with that, I'm going to... we've got just a quick minute or two.
Very quick question. I've had a few people, sometimes with elected officials we define, many people have called me, that's larger than two and less than four. But I've had a few people call me, and it was seemed like a large number because they had some real difficult diseases that they had found medications for that the doctors were prescribing, and the insurance companies weren't going to honor that. How are you doing getting some of your drugs onto the insurance list so that they can be used? Is that a difficult problem for you?
Yeah, it's Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's a very good question, and I tell you, this is a rapidly changing area for our industry. There's a lot of focus on this on Capitol Hill and certainly within state legislatures as well. Getting payers, whether they're public payers or private payers, to allow access to new drugs is very difficult. We've got, you know, teams of people that do this on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the teams are not quite large enough because we're not a large enough company yet, but it's a big focus for us. We didn't have anybody who interacted with CMS, with Medicare and Medicaid, up until about a year ago. Frankly, we had to do this because we got in trouble with one of our products where they weren't allowing the correct payment for Aloxi, as a matter of fact, in cancer centers. So for us, working with the payers has been a little bit of baptism by fire, and they're rapidly changing. The private payers really tend to follow what Medicare and Medicaid do in many cases. I guess one thing I'll leave you with, and then I know we need to finish up here. You're going to hear a lot more about pharmacogenomic research, where basically they're trying to identify genes that may relate to a particular disease or biological process. As they do this, they'll be able to look at me and Ray and all of us and say, well, you happen to be a carrier for a particular disease. We can build a drug just for
you know, the three of us or four of us that may happen to be that particular carrier, patient populations are going to get smaller. The good thing is the treatments are going to be more effective. They're going to be less toxic. The challenge is there's small patient populations, and the price of those products is, you know, it's going to be challenging.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. I will tell you, try to remind you about our tour on Friday, February 2nd. Please get back to us if you're going to be able to make it from 9:30 to 11:30 at the Minnetonka location for St. Jude's. And there is in your packet this Pathways Toward Renewable Energy feature that's going to be done at the university. Tomorrow we'll be hearing a couple of bills, so until then, we'll see you tomorrow.